Good evening. New Year's is celebrated around the globe. An Iraqi militia seized the United States Embassy in Baghdad and the Attorney General's assault on the right to protest. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the news for New Year's Eve, Tuesday, December 31st, 2019. New Year's spectacular in Dubai. The celebrations began in the island nation of Samoa, marching westward, touching city after city where thousands gathered for fireworks and protest. Thousands of Hong Kong revelers welcomed in 2020 on neon-lit promenades along the picturesque Victoria Harbor. Authorities had canceled the popular New Year's fireworks for the first time in a decade, citing security concerns. A symphony of lights took place instead. The carnival atmosphere was interrupted as parts of the crowd of thousands began chanting "Liberate Hong Kong." On January 1st, tomorrow, tens of thousands of people are expected to join a pro-democracy march starting from a park downtown and ending in the heart of the Central Financial District. In Sydney, Australia, the Lord Mayor defended his decision to stage the city's dramatic fireworks display. Speaking earlier on Tuesday, Clover Moore said the celebration would give hope to people. Parts of Australia have been ravaged by bushfires, intensified by high temperatures, and months of drought. Critics of the Sydney display had argued that going ahead with it would send the wrong message. Meanwhile, thousands swarmed the beaches on Australia's east coast on Tuesday to escape fierce wildfires bearing down on several seaside towns as the government readied naval vessels and military helicopters to aid firefighting and evacuations. The huge bushfires have destroyed more than 10 million acres, with new blazes sparked into life almost daily by extremely hot and windy conditions in bushland left tinder dry after a three-year drought. About 4,000 people in the town of Mallacoota in Victoria headed to the waterfront after the main road was cut off. Those who could not make it were scrambling for shelter in a gymnasium and other public buildings as emergency sirens wailed. The fires have been spread across four states, with fronts stretching hundreds of miles in some cases, affecting many towns and rural areas. Protesters angry about U.S. airstrikes on Iraq hurled stones and torches security posts at the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad on Tuesday, setting off a confrontation with guards and posing a new challenge for U.S. President Donald Trump. In a scene reminiscent of the 1979 seizure of the American Embassy in neighboring Iran, the protesters, this time led by Iranian-backed militias, broke down a gate using a battering ram and entered the compound where they began setting fires. Iraqi Special Forces prevented protesters entering, later reinforced by U.S.-trained Iraqi counterterrorism forces. The State Department said diplomatic personnel inside were safe and there were no plans to evacuate them. President Trump said in a tweet, "Iran will be held fully responsible for lives lost or damage incurred at any of our facilities. They will pay a very big price," in capital letters he wrote with an exclamation point. "This is not a warning, capital W. It is a threat," with a capital T. The protests followed U.S. airstrikes on Sunday on bases operated by an Iranian-backed militia inside Iraq, killing at least 25 fighters and wounding 55. The strikes were retaliation for the killing of a U.S. civilian contractor in a rocket attack. An Iraqi-American political analyst, Rahed Jarar, says today's events are a clear escalation in Trump's confrontation with Iran.
The implications of it are important, and I think it's also an indication of a very important new escalation between the U.S. and Iran. So it is different than business as usual. What we see today in Iraq is nothing more than consequences of very bad decisions that were made in the 90s and in the early 2000s. The U.S. continues to be viewed as a foreign invader, a foreign country that is messing with Iraq and interfering in its business. And more importantly, as a country that is supporting the oppressive sectarian Iraqi government. And this Iraqi government has killed hundreds of unarmed protesters and injured thousands only in the last few months. So the U.S. is viewed very, very negatively in Iraq because of its actions over the last few decades.
Why was there an attack in the first place that killed this advisor, U.S. advisor, contractor?
There are two parallel tracks going on at the same time in Iraq. There is a legitimate movement of protests that have swept the country since early October. Parallel to that, there is an escalation between the U.S. and Iran. The U.S. and Iran just so happen to be the main two powers interfering in Iraq over the last few decades. So there is an escalation between these two countries where the U.S. is trying to blame Iran for the mess in Iraq, and Iran is trying to blame the U.S. for the mess. So we saw a few attacks against U.S. bases over the last couple months. I think the number that I saw this morning was a total of 11 attacks by pro-Iranian militias against U.S. bases, hoping to have some sort of a confrontation, because Iran would love to point fingers to the U.S., and the U.S. loves to point fingers to Iran. So I would say what happened in the morning with the protests outside the U.S. embassy wasn't really linked to the legitimate and authentic protest that is happening in Iraq, because most of the people who stormed the embassy were linked to this pro-Iranian militia that has access to the green zone. You know, not everyone can enter the green zone and go protest outside the U.S. embassy. So it's more of an escalation of a proxy war parallel to the legitimate and authentic protests that have been happening in the country.
What is the relationship of this to the legitimate protests, as you call it, and to the president of Iraq, who it seems was almost allowing, as they said, they couldn't have been there without his permission?
I wouldn't just blame it on the president. I would blame it on the entire Iraqi government. The Iraqi government is very, very weak, and it is controlled by the U.S. and Iran. What we saw happen in the last week is actually a good example. The U.S. called the Iraqi prime minister to inform him that they will be bombing a military base of this Iraqi militia, Hezbollah, in western Iraq. And the prime minister said no, but the U.S. bombed it anyway. This morning, there were similar news about how the head of this militia, Hezbollah, informed the Iraqi government that they will be storming the Green Zone to attack the U.S. embassy. And the Iraqi government also said no, but they did it anyway. So you see that the Iraqi government is weak, beholden to foreign powers such as Iran and the U.S., and doesn't have any power to protect its sovereignty, let alone the sovereignty of an embassy here or a consulate there. So it is a good way to view the events by seeing how weak and dominated this Iraqi government is.
What's causing all these protests?
Iraqis are mostly protesting the corrupt and sectarian government. And believe it or not, one of the top three issues that Iraqis have been protesting is foreign intervention. What the Iraqis have been saying is that this Iraqi government is so weak that it is reliant on the U.S. and on Iran, that the U.S. and Iran have been arming and training the Iraqi government and their militias. And these militias have been making life in Iraq hell on earth. Just to give you an example, I'm sure your audiences would appreciate this. This militia that we're talking about this morning, the one that stormed the U.S. embassy, the one that was bombed by the U.S. a few days ago, is the exact same militia that was found with five U.S. Abrams tanks a couple of years back. It is true that this is a pro-Iranian militia, but it's also funded and trained by the U.S. And when Iraqis view Hezbollah or other militias, they view it as a problem because of their actions, but they also view them as a problem because of the U.S.-Iranian influence and U.S.-Iranian support.
Where is this going to end up?
Escalations between the U.S. and Iran are getting to a point that is truly unprecedented. Whether you look at Syria or Yemen, or now Iraq. The two countries are involved in a very, very sensitive set of proxy wars. And they're both playing with fire. I agree that we are getting to a point where full-on, like full-blown war is not a very far-fetched possibility. I think the U.S. has to make some really smart choices in the upcoming weeks and months rather than doubling down and escalating more in Iraq. I think the U.S. should hear what the Iraqi people have been saying, which is the Iraqis want the U.S. to leave their country. The Iraqis want the U.S. and Iran to leave the country. But from our perspective here, we should be calling on our government to leave Iraq and de-escalate rather than doubling down and starting a new war.
Iraqi-American political analyst Rahed Jarar. Democrats upset that Trump ditched the Iran nuclear deal negotiated by Democratic President Barack Obama in 2015, were quick to pounce on the incident as a failure of Trump's Iran's policy. More than 5,000 U.S. troops are stationed in Iraq supporting the local forces. And North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has accused the Trump administration of dragging its feet in nuclear negotiations and warned that his country will soon show a new strategic weapon to the world as it bolsters its nuclear deterrent in face of what he called gangster-like U.S. sanctions and pressure. The North state media said Wednesday that Kim made the comments during a four-day ruling party conference held through Tuesday in the capital, Pyongyang, where he declared that the North will never give up its security for economic benefits in the face of what he described as increasing U.S. hostility and nuclear threats. Kim's comments came after a months-long standoff between Washington and Pyongyang over disagreements involving disarmament steps and the removal of sanctions imposed on the North. And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. In national news, earlier this month, Attorney General William Barr gave a speech to a conservative group saying that cops would be justified in withholding protection from communities that don't give police adequate respect.
You know, in the Vietnam era, our country learned a lesson. I remember that our brave troops who served in that conflict weren't treated very well in many cases when they came home. And sometimes they bore the brunt of people who were opposed to the war. And the respect and gratitude owed them was not given. And it took decades for the American people finally to realize that. And I'm very happy today when I'm at an airport and troops come through, coming back or being deployed, there's frequently everything stops and they get a round of applause because people recognize that that's the right thing to do for these people who are serving us. But I think today American people have to focus on something else, which is the sacrifice and the service that is given by our law enforcement officers. And they have to start showing more than they do the respect and support that law enforcement deserves. And if communities don't give that support and respect, they may find themselves without the police protection they need.
In another speech to the Fraternal Order of Police last August, Barr directed his anger at people he called social justice advocates, who he says are demoralizing the police.
There's another development that is demoralizing to us in law enforcement and dangerous to the public safety. That is the emergence in some of our large cities of district attorneys that style themselves social justice reformers and spend their time undercutting the police, letting criminals off the hook, and refusing to enforce the laws. Most disturbing is that some are actually refusing to prosecute cases of resistance to the police. And today, violent crime has been cut in half. Unfortunately, in the last few years of the Obama administration, the violent crime rates started rising again. Now, on the drug front, we are facing a monumental challenge. To be frank, the Obama administration showed little interest in prosecuting the fight against dangerous drugs. A tsunami built up and has been crashing over the country. bringing death and destruction.
Following a decades-old line of reasoning that police are a group that should be protected in the same way as a gender or an ethnic or religious minority, a historian at the University of Baltimore is Joshua Davis. He's penned an article on Barr's statements for The Nation. He says Blue Lives Matter is not social justice advocacy.
No, being blue is not the same as racial identity or gender or sexual identity. But I think you're exactly right that that's the implication of this war on police narrative, this narrative about Blue Lives Matter. The idea is that somehow that profession faces a level and form of discrimination that approaches what people of color experience or what the LGBTQ community experiences. And we know that that's not true. I think what to me is so interesting about that narrative, though, is that people have pointed out, historians have pointed out, others have pointed out that in a lot of ways, Donald Trump seems like a throwback to George Wallace, right? The former governor of Alabama, segregationist, who also ran for president several times.
A man who was a demagogue who actually ran for president, got 10 million votes, I believe, at that time. A lot of votes, even though he was a third party.
He won electoral votes also. He wasn't just someone who got 10 or 15%. And I think a lot of people have seen how his rhetoric and just the unapologetic racism, it's not even really that he used a lot of dog whistles or coded language. It's that he just embraced denigrating Black Americans, all kinds of people, kind of like Trump does, and same kind of demagogic appeals, same kind of right-wing nationalism and populism. And I think going along with that, I think Attorney General Barr, in some ways, this war on police narrative he's been pushing is a throwback to that era. It's a throwback to the white backlash against civil rights, which has never really left us, but has waxed and waned and obviously is really on the rise the last few years, it would seem.
How can they say that the crime rate is going up and we live in a more unsafe time because of liberals or Democrats in rule or Obama being the president when in every city around the country it's pretty, you know, even Chicago's had 3 years of violence declines in the last 3 years?
Great question. Yeah, in a lot of ways, really, Trump's narrative, Barr's way of talking, harkens back to the 80s and 90s, and I think it's very convenient for them to ignore crime statistics, but they'd really like to latch on to crime as a racial pathology, as crime as the result of democratic failures, right? And to somehow draw a straight line from the fact that a city is run by Democrats, maybe not even progressives or leftists, but that it's run by Democrats. And therefore, because there has been far too many shootings in Chicago, even though the crime statistics in all kinds of different ways are down, that there's a connection between those two, that somehow there's a laxity, there's a permissiveness that's built into the Democratic Party.
Like a tabloid newspaper or Fox News, or it's interesting the president was very close to the National Enquirer, latching on to one story, one horrific story, and just making it seem like this happens every day in every part of the country all the time.
I'm here in Baltimore, and so last summer, before Representative Elijah Cummings died, you know, the president went on a multi-day tirade against our whole city, and the whole way he imputed Cummings in our city was one to highlight rats and two to highlight crime and to say that somehow this person as a political elected official is responsible for a crime rate that's very much an outgrowth of social problems and of much deeper issues than something that's attributable to a political party.
Where does Barr come into this? How did the attorney general become part of this discussion?
On December 3rd, he gave a speech at an award ceremony that the Department of Justice gives. Really, it's an award that Barr initiated himself. I think it's called the Law Enforcement Awards. And they've only done it for 3 or 4 years. But he gave a speech in which he uttered the lines that I referenced, that basically Americans who don't do more to respect and honor the police are in danger of not getting to enjoy protection from the police. In some ways, it's not unlike what you all experienced in New York City after Eric Garner, was killed in late, was that 2014? Mm-hmm, there were protests all over the city, all over the country. And then NYPD did a slowdown, right? They did a major announced slowdown where they started responding to fewer calls. And basically they were saying, hey, if you criticize us unfairly, then we're just going to stop doing our job and you're going to suffer. So that was what Barr, I think, came in with. And there's another speech he gave in August to the National Fraternal Order of Police that was even more reckless and, I would say, ruthless than the speech he gave on December 3rd. And that was what I really read, where I said, wow, this really sounds like the rhetoric of police chiefs in the 1960s criticizing the civil rights movement.
What is he signaling to people would happen? What do you think he's trying to scare us with?
It is supposed to have a chilling effect on people who criticize the police, protest the police, and not just the, I'm not saying people who are anti-police. I'm talking about people who want to make law enforcement more accountable. And he is trying to intimidate those people, I think, in a way to say that police protection is a transaction. Police protection, citizens being protected by law enforcement, is somehow contingent upon not questioning law enforcement, to just universally, unquestioningly respect what they do without ever asking for accountability or for transparency.
The police are not required to enforce the law.
Neo-Nazis beating up civil rights protesters, and then civil rights protesters going to police who are watching and saying, why don't you protect us? And then officers just turning a blind eye, essentially.
That's sort of the threat, isn't it?
That seems to be. And I think Barr, really, without saying the words Black Lives Matter and without naming certain reform-minded district attorneys like Larry Krasner or Chesa Boudin, newly elected in San Francisco, he wanted to put those folks on notice and say, hey, you're playing dirty. We're going to throw it right back in your face, and there are going to be bad consequences for you for criticizing us and not backing us up.
Joshua Davis is a historian at the University of Baltimore. And in impeachment news, at a town hall in New Hampshire, Democratic candidate Tulsi Gabbard explained why she voted present on the two articles of impeachment that were passed by the House against Trump. She says it'll only make him mad.
Throughout this process, it was and continues to be extremely partisan. And this is something that the founders warned against in the Federalist Papers, that the process, they feared that the process would result in a conclusion that was based on the strength of one party over another rather than an objective assessment of innocence or guilt, and that such an outcome would only further.
But attorney and former judge Bill Blum, who has an article on the Trump impeachment in the Progressive magazine, says it's not that Trump shouldn't be impeached for Ukraine. It's just not the only thing he should be impeached for.
In addition to the abuse of power with regard to Ukraine and obstruction of Congress, there should be at least coverage of his violation of the emoluments clauses, because he's using the presidency as a vehicle for personal and economic enrichment.
I was just listening to Tulsi Gabbard. She voted present, not voting, on both articles of impeachment.
My understanding of her position is that she thinks that impeachment will embolden Donald Trump and make things worse. I disagree with her completely. My analysis is that Donald Trump is an American fascist, and my understanding of history is that you cannot appease fascism. You have to attack it, and impeachment is one front of the battle against this emerging new form of fascism. I think that there's ample reason to impeach and remove Donald Trump, and I agree with people like Ralph Nader on that score. The criticism I have of the Democrats is that the articles of impeachment that they've passed, while valid, are not broad enough. So I don't agree with her. Of course, she's entitled to her position, but I think that voting present is sort of a cop-out. If you think that impeachment is a mistake and impeachment is a hybrid of law and politics, then vote against these articles. But voting present, I think, isn't really the way to go. But I don't focus on Tulsi Gabbard. I think that she's a minor player in all of this. Right. And the larger drama is how you defeat Donald Trump and where impeachment comes in. I don't think that progressives should place all their eggs in the impeachment basket. In fact, I think that the main struggle is beyond impeachment. But I think that as far as impeachment goes, it's a very important development in our history. Trump is now the third American president to be impeached. Richard Nixon never was impeached. He resigned before he could be. And we should support the process generally, like Bernie Sanders is doing, but recognize that we have to have a program that addresses a whole multitude of issues that will set us apart from Donald Trump.
What are emoluments?
Emoluments are payments or gifts that are not authorized by Congress. And the Foreign Emoluments Clause prohibits the president from receiving any payment, gift, or benefit from foreign states without the approval of Congress. And the Domestic Emoluments Clause prohibits the president from receiving any benefit from the federal government or the states beyond his salary. And the Foreign Clause applies to all federal officials. The Domestic Clause doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically what it is. And they're anti-corruption provisions.
Has there ever been a situation where there was an American president who was that corrupt?
You know, I don't think that there's anyone whose corruption meets the volume, the depth of Trump's corruption. And I think it's, this gets back to Gabbard's comment, I think it's going to get worse with him regardless of the impeachment. If he's reelected, he's really going to feel emboldened anyway. And he's got an attorney general in William Barr who is running interference for him and appears dead set on establishing a Christian theocracy in America. I think that we're in for very, very difficult times ahead. And so I look at impeachment as one other battle that he's got to fight. And, you know, you win a war by fighting on multiple fronts.
Attorney and former judge Bill Blum, his article is in the Progressive magazine. And that's some of the news for New Year's Eve, December 31st, 2019. The news was engineered by Ken Gale. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Have a great new year.